Hare Krishna, this is Dhananath Swami. Koti Koti, which means many, many, many apologies. I actually spent a lot of time today preparing for the class. I don't know if most of you know, I have a yoga studio that's above where I stay. And two devotees, one that lives here in the next house, her name is Samantha. I guess, I don't know why she's staying here. And a person named TJ, who lives in the neighborhood. They wanted to learn the nectar of devotion. So I just started teaching them, and I thought it was only a half hour, and then thankfully, Rutte called me at 9:15. So please excuse me. I really didn't mean to be late. I'm sorry about that. But hopefully we'll have a very enlivening class, and my offense will be removed. Okay. Let me see where we're at now. Yeah, okay. Okay. Reading from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Text 51. No, actually, text 52. Shiyate prakasa adanam. Then the covering of the illumination of knowledge is weakened. Omigana timarandasya. Gananjana Salakaya Taksurun Mulatam Yena Tasmai Si Bhavai Namaha Vanshakalpa Sarubhyascha Kripashindu Vayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah. So, greetings from New York. I'm, as I guess I just hinted, I'm back up where I'm staying, and it's sad to leave Vrindavan, but at the same time, this is like a Himalayan hermitage, you know, it's out in the country, it's so peaceful and so quiet, and it's very, very productive. Okay, let me just put us up to date on the Yoga Sutras here. We're discussing the section on Ashtanga Yoga, because real yoga is this meditative absorption, high level. I explained it many times. It's a very, when you're actually able to meditate and focus, then the vrittis are subdued. So to come to a point where you set that psychological mechanism into place where you're actually able to move the mind to goodness takes a certain preliminary level of goodness to begin with. So the first chapter is the meditative absorption. The second chapter is the practice, how to get to that point of real yoga. So it described Kriya Yoga, a threefold process of tapasya, austerity, swadhyaya, study, and which includes, anyway, I'm not going to go into that now, we discussed it so many times, and submission to God. Then it began to discuss Ashtanga Yoga, that you can also have a more elaborate eightfold process. And we've been discussing that with the beginning with the yams and the niyams, and we completed. So it was a very nice, elaborate study of the moral restraints, how you deal with others, the five moral restraints, and the niyams, the moral observances, how you have to deal with yourself. And these are mandatory building blocks if you want to really get the bloom of yoga. If you really want to get to the level of absorption and meditation to affect this dynamic psychological change of subduing the vrittis, or the fluctuations of the mind that distort the mechanism of the mind, which distort the mechanism of the mind away from its pure function of lucidity and clarity that allows you to actually understand yourself. And that's really the purpose of yoga. To see, understand, and realize yourself. To imbibe in your own pure, blissful nature. And to do that takes a mind which is in goodness. So the yam and niyams were discussed, and then to encourage the practice of these yams and niyams, Patanjali indicates what are the benefits of doing so. This is even in the bhakti process. And bhakti means it should be causeless without motive. Still, there's enticements to practice. There's enticements to hear. Just like if you read the shastra, even the bhakti shastra, at the end of the chapters, at the end of the story, there'll be a full shruti, the fruit of hearing, to encourage you. Just like I was reading the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the story of Haridas Thakur, a beautiful story. And it says anybody who hears this story will achieve, will never take birth again in this world. Anybody who hears this story of Haridas Thakur, you'll certainly be free from the bonds of this world. So they described the different benefits, and just finish that section in a nice way. The last niyam, moral observances, is that one should be certified, one should surrender to God. And what you're doing should be done in a devotional and dedicated way. And I just wanted to repeat, which is just a very, very interesting point that was brought out so clearly in the commentaries, that the benefit of surrendering to God is that samadhi is achieved, which is very interesting because of all the other niyams, the praktik or material benefits. But surrendering to God, Ishvara Pranayama, you can achieve the goal of yoga itself. And it's a very beautiful statement where Professor Brian, I really liked how he developed this, is that it was also in the beginning chapter of meditative absorption, it was also a recommended, optional but recommended, object of meditation. And when it's described in this way, that when you actually follow this, you can actually get the benefit of samadhi. A very interesting statement is made. He says, in addition to serving as a meditational prop for the mind, it can intervene and bypass or at least accelerate the normal practice of a normal process of practice by bestowing samadhi on the practitioner as an act of grace. So it's not just the meditational prop. It's not just something to focus the mind, to subdue the vrittis, but in addition to being an object of meditation that allows you to do that, it's a object of meditation that intervenes and accelerates the normal practice by grace, by actually giving you something. And what it gives is actually the goal of yoga itself is samadhi. So that's niyam and yam. And then just briefly, because we're in the section of pranayam now, then posture was described, and posture should be steady and comfortable. And there's a purpose of that, and the purpose is meditation, because everything is to serve meditation. It's not just exercise, but it's exercise in the service of meditation. And without the goal of meditation, then it has no spiritual benefit in itself. So meditation can only be possible if one is sitting firmly and comfortably. And therefore, the posture is useful only to the extent which it facilitates fixing the mind comfortably. So asana was not the goal, meditation is. Of course, it's important because meditation is very, very difficult to achieve unless the body supports the meditation. And the way the body supports the meditation is that it doesn't serve as an impediment to the meditation. Because generally, our bodies are impediments to the mind. Because the mind should be focusing in meditation on a particular object is distracted by the discomfort of the body. So this is important in any type of practice. You want japa meditation, there has to be some, the body should not be a distraction. And so asana, although it's one of the limbs, it's not described extensively in the Yoga Sutras, perhaps 1/100th of the descriptions is the asana, it should be steady and comfortable. To facilitate fixing the mind. So it's not a goal in itself, but it substantially facilitates the goal of meditation absorption. And then he says such posture should be attained, relaxation of effort and absorption in the infinite. Relaxation of effort means that the perfection is that you forget the body. So you know, there may be strain, there may be difficult in this exercise, but the point is to come to a point where one is in the asana in a very relaxed way so he can be absorbed in the infinite. And the infinite is Ananta, which is very interesting because we know that Ananta also refers to Anantasesha. And Anantasesha is the serpent of Vishnu. It's a manifestation of Vishnu that holds up the universes. So Ananta holds up the universes. So in the same way, the posture should facilitate the absorption. As Ananta holds up the universes, the body should effortlessly support the concentration and fixation of the mind. And therefore, the body should be the posture should be attained eventually by a very relaxed effort. Basically meaning that you forget the body. And just going on, and then he says, then one is not afflicted by the dualities. What are the dualities? The pains, the pleasures, the heat, the cold, all these things distract us from meditation. If we're on the bodily platform, if it's too cold, we're distressed. If it's too hot, we're distressed. You know, if a mosquito comes, we're distressed. If there's pain, if there's... purpose is when you lose this awareness of the body, and then you're free from duality. So this is also the purpose of asana. You can become detached from the body. That's actual purpose. And when that asana is accomplished, then pranayam, breath control, follows, which just consists of the regulation of the incoming and outgoing breaths. So it says, tasman sati, that is attained, indicates it's progressive. So you have to do yam, niyam, asana, pranayam. It's progressive. Tasmanati, it is attained. When you do one, then you can attain the other. So you want to do pranayam, you have to do asana. You want to do asana, you have to do yam and niyam. Because the whole purpose is to fix the mind. And what disturbs the mind, what fluctuates the mind, the basis of the fluctuation of the mind is the egotistical selfish desires. So if one is violent, the mind is externalized in so many ways. The mind is disturbed in so many ways. So you can't be violent and then be a meditator. You have to have the core. Ahimsa must be there. Nonviolence must be there. And you can't have the other yams and niyams if you're not nonviolent. Because material consciousness is there. The root of the consciousness being reflected on the body is for what? It's for selfishness. That's the basic core. That's the basic conception that, the soul, the original pure nature of the soul is to imbibe and live in its own nature. Living in its own nature is living in the nature of purity and selflessness. So what's bringing the consciousness out to the body, which necessitates the practice of yoga to become free from that identification, it's this selfishness. So unless you have practiced moral restraints, what is the question of meditation? There's no desire for meditation. Well, if one is in material consciousness, then what is the desire to control the vrittis, the fluctuations of the mind, or what? They're fluctuations for selfishness, their fluctuations against our essence, their fluctuations against the nature of the soul. So the point here that's being made by Pantanjali is when that asana is accomplished, pranayama follows. In other words, one follows the other. They're a progression of focus and meditation. It's focus. Just you know, focus. Something is blurry, and it becomes, you know, clearer and clearer and clearer and clearer, like a focus. So meditation is like that. If you've studied, we studied in the first chapter that meditation is extremely focused and intense. First, you're meditating on the object, and then you're meditating beyond the object to the subtle elements of the object itself. Then you're meditating beyond that to the prakriti or matter itself. The meditational process is just gets more and more increasingly focused. So, you know, it has to start from a platform. It starts from moral restraint. If the consciousness is so externalized that one is in the consciousness of exploitation of others, what's the question of focusing the mind away from those fluctuations, away from those selfish desires? So asana is accomplished in pranayama, and this consists of regulation of the incoming and outgoing breaths. And it's just a simple point. You cannot, if you cannot pass yam, niyam, and asana, then what is the question of meditative absorption? Because meditative absorption cannot be attained while passion, rajas, and tamas are prominent. That's what prevents meditative absorption. Think of yourself trying to chant dhamma. What is preventing your focus? It's the mode that you are in. So if the lifestyle is not restrained, what is the question of the meditation? When you sit down, you'll be your mind will be so. What is rajas? Rajas or passion, the symptom of shape or distraction, and the symptom of tamas or ignorance is lethargy. These are the two core modes that prevent this meditative absorption. Either you're sleeping, or you're distracted. So how can you come to a platform of pranayama and you know, which is the preliminary point of meditation, if you cannot pass yam, niyam, and asana, which are specifically meant to subdue the gross association with passion and ignorance? So it's very, very systematic. And okay, so now that you've got to that point, and you can do breath control because you're subduing the lower modes, then it's a suspension of breath, means after pravas, exhalation, or svasa, inhalation, you suspend the breath. Again, the same thing. It's not just the suspension of the breath. It's the concentration of the mind. And the suppression of the vrittis. It's not just a physical effort, but it's a physical effort to support a mental effort. It's a physical effort to support a mental effort. The suppression suppression of the vrittis. It's for the concentration of the mind. And then, and then 50, pranayama manifests as external, internal, and restrained movements. These are drawn out and subtle in accordance to place, time. We'll do that verse today. That's 50. Okay. So pranayama manifests as external, internal, and restrained. They are drawn out and subtle in accordance to place, time, and number. Commentators refer to this as Rechika, Purika, and Kumbhaka. So the movement of breath ceases. So there's three things again. It's as external, the breath is held after exhalation, internal, there's no flow after inhalation, and restrained. And restrained means the breath ceases. How does he put this? The breath ceases just as water shrinks and contracts from all sides and evaporates when it is sprinkled on a heated stone. Inner is remains within the body and it ceases to move in and out. It becomes motionless. It's just like the breath is breathing out, the breath is breathing in. And the particular time is described that, like when the very nice analogy is when water fills a jar. When water fills a jar, it remains motionless. So there's the yogi, eventually he can actually basically stop his breath. And the breath somehow remains inside, and he somehow gets life from the prana itself. So this is describing the different types of pranayama. And then it says, it's accordance to place, time, and number. Place is how far the breath is, how far the breath is, how far the surface is reached by the breath. Time, as the how long the breath is stopped, and number, how many times you do it. This is just some of the technicalities of it. Commentators actually give different descriptions and time measurements of the proportions of how long when you breathe in, how long that you breathe in, then how long you hold it, how long you breathe out, and what you meditate on while you do it, and how the breath is connected to the mind, and how by this practice of pranayama, one achieves one has the ability to control the mind and subdue the mind and therefore meditate. And remember, this meditation is a very, very ingenious psychosomatic strategy of subduing the mind, because the mind is being transformed by these fluctuations and these thoughts, these vrittis. It's just being and the strategy, this brilliant strategy of pranayama, of meditation, is you fix on one thing, And by fixing on one thing and practicing that fixing on one thing, then you're neglecting or subduing the myriad of fluctuations. And it's a very, very powerful way to still the mind and bring the mind to a more effective condition of utility, of reflection of the nature of the soul. And so here he's describing, this is, you know, after asana, the body is still, then this pranayama is just very, very, controlling the breath is very, very powerful for subduing the vrittis, especially when this internal chanting of mantra as an alternative to then just particularly counting sections of time. Anyway, gradually by this practice, the breath becomes more and more restrained, more and more prolonged, more and more imperceptible in terms of the movement of air, and it, to an extent that even cotton will not move when put a piece of cotton is put by the nostril, it will not even move. So when you come to that point of restraint of breath. In other words, the breath is going out and in, and it becomes more and more subtle when it comes to such an extent that practically the breath is not even moving. It's so imperceptible. Then in a corresponding way, the mind, the fluctuations of the mind are also becoming subdued, and that deep concentration, ekagra, on just one thing becomes more and more fixed. And one begins to achieve the platform of yoga. And as we read in the first chapters, what this means is the mind is an instrument. And when the mind is in goodness or sattva, which means the original state of matter, mind is material. When it comes to the original state of matter, it's described like a clean mirror. A clean mirror is completely reflective. And as the mind is the vehicle by which the embodied soul perceives things, then the soul is able to have clear perception. And when the soul has clear perception, the soul can see itself perfectly and see the distinction between the purusha or the soul and the body. But this takes a perfection of sattva, a pure condition of the mind, free from any fluctuations. So this platform of meditative absorption is very, very, very increasingly more and more and more subtle. So you can see this is the fourth stage. So pursuing this path, which is basically not really recommended in Bhagavad Gita because it's so difficult to just, actually Arjuna even says, I mean, this is, how do I control the mind? To control the mind is more difficult to control than the raging wind. It is possible by constant practice and detachment. Now, what happens is in the next verse, The fourth type of pranayama surpasses the limits of the external and internal. So we had three stages of pranayama or restraint. After the exhalation, then after the inhalation, and then there's a kumbhika, there's a restraint to the fact that there's no exhalation or inhalation. Somehow the breath is maintained internally. Now there's a fourth stage, and as often in the Yoga Sutras, higher stages are not easily described because they're based on an experience that can't be easily translated into words. Therefore, the commentators don't say much. Between this third type of pranayama, this fourth type, which is called chaturtha, and the third type, which is called kumbhaka, not described so clearly the difference or explained intellectually. Vyas states that the third type is brought about by a single effort, while the fourth takes place gradually with prolonged effort. Maybe it's just like in bhakti, when you achieve a higher stage of love of God, which is called bhava. Very interesting concept that God has a pleasure potency, which is love. And for God to enjoy love, it must be placed external to himself. So our function is to be receptacles of that love. And the first manifestation of it in the consciousness is called bhava. And a further manifestation is called prema. So they're the same thing, except one is lax and one is dense. It's like there's the sun rays or heat and light, and then there's the sun globe, there's heat and light. So they're both heat and light, but there's a subtle difference. So there must be a subtle difference here in the level of restraint, because the third type, kumbhaka, is already restraining the external internal breaths. So what can be beyond that? But somehow or other, Vyasa is trying to it just seems like this fourth type, it's mentioned, it basically it means that this is the difference I now am seeing in the commentary. First is exhalation and suppression of breath, this inhalation of suppression of breath, then this exhalation and suppression of breath, then there's just suppression of breath, and there's no exhalation or inhalation. But when that is held, not just for when it's held for an extended period of time, then that's the fourth stage, where the body is maintained by the internal circulation of prana. There's actually no breath, and it can be maintained at will. Even for months or years, I guess that's this fourth stage of pranayama. The practical application is, one practical application of this is that this type of practice is not something that we can readily achieve. The practical application of it is it gives us outlines and it gives us guidelines for meditation. We can practice to a certain level. It also points to the necessity of bhakti or grace to achieve perfection. Because this yoga isn't outside-in process. You're dealing very subtly with the mind to reveal the soul. And the bhakti process deals directly with the soul to purify the mind. And grace is required. This is amazingly... Every time I'm reading the Yoga Sutras and delving into the Yoga Sutras, I'm amazed by the levels of subtleties, how things go more and more subtle, and the level of control of mind and restraint. And it's certainly not a process that's meant to be perfected. And Bhagavad Gita mentions in the sixth chapter that when you want to begin a process like that, you begin from sannyas. There can be no family for this level of concentration. You can't be in the world to this level of concentration. You have to be completely celibate from this level of concentration. You have to be in a place that supports it fully, like the Himalayas. I was thinking, coming upstate New York now, and also, you know, the families that are here, they went to India. I'm here all alone, basically. There's sometimes the yoga is upstairs, but I'm here all alone. And, you know, it's snow outside. I'm just saying, wow, this is so supportive of meditation. So you need the environment. You need a particular stage of life to perfect this. Anyway, all shastras, Buddhistic traditions, Jain traditions, Upanishadic traditions, they all describe this equalizing of the incoming and outgoing breath. And in advanced yoga practice or yoga practice, it plays a central role. And the different commentators actually mention people they knew who could be buried alive. One mentions he knew someone. Hari Haryananda mentioned he knew someone that was buried alive for 10 or 12 days as a result of his ability to restrain the breath. And Dasgupta witnessed a yogi remaining in a state of suspended animation, and he's modern times, for 9 days without intake or food or drink and devoid of even heartbeat. And there's accounts documented in the court of one king about one Haridas buried alive. And this is 1837. And with extensive precautions against fraud, which were documented by even the British. So it's full of accounts like this. And in the Bhagavatam, we have the story of Dhruva Maharaj, who was a young boy, and the father had different wives, and Dhruva's mother was the older wife and not as favored by the king. So when he went to sit on his father's lap, the younger wife, who was the favorite of the king, would not allow him to climb on the lap of his father. And Dhruva, who was a warrior, he was so offended but his mother advised him that he was so offended, he said that now I can't sit on my father's lap. I want a kingdom greater than Lord Brahma. And Dhruva's mother advised him, who is a neglected co-wife, that if you practice austerities and worship the Supreme Lord, then you can achieve your desires. And then he meets Narada, who gives him a practice, how to meditate and worship Vishnu, which include the practice of Rechika, Puraka, Kumbhaka, the restraint of the breath, and meditation on a mantra. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, because there's two ways you can restrain the breath, because it's mechanical, so you have to count. So you can count by these periods of time, either called shana or matra, they're milliseconds, So it's like, you know, 16 milliseconds, inhale, 30, you know, 64 milliseconds, restrain, you know, suppressed, and exhale for a certain amount. Or you can chant mantra. And mantra is always recommended. If you think of classical meditation of the yogis, although they can meditate on any object, they generally meditated on God by chanting Om, which is the syllable in the Shastra that which designates the Supreme Absolute Reality. They would meditate on Om. So Dhruva, he did this, and in his mind it was Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So he would meditate like that, and he's only 5 years old, but he performed it so strictly with such severe austerities. After the 6th day, he renounced all food, and then he stopped drinking, and then he was inhaling every 14 days and every 15 days. So he suppressed the breath for 14 or 15 days. So this is Chaturtha, described by Patanjali, where you just live on the prana. And for the 5th month, he restrained from all activities. He stopped breathing completely, and he extended the pranayama, or the breath restraint, to the maximum degree. And he focused. He was able to focus exclusively on Vishnu as the mantra was being chanted. And because of this complete absorption, not just the restraint of breath, you know, his consciousness became so expansive that actually the universe was suffocating. That's described in the next chapter. A yogi absorbs the quality of the object of meditation by absorption in that object. That's called samya. So he's meditating on Vishnu, the supreme soul who pervaded the universe. And he took on the qualities of Vishnu, and his consciousness pervaded the universe, and therefore his breathing was suffocating the universe. So there's different examples. So then it finishes with 2 verses. It says, then the covering of illumination is weakened, the covering of knowledge, the covering of perception is weakened by this pranayama, which is called prakas avarna. Tata shiate prakas avarna. The shiate, then, this covering of the pure mind is destroyed. In other words, the covering means of illumination. What is illumination? Illumination is when the mind is in sattva. The natural state of the mind is it has extreme lucidity. The mind becomes a perfect instrument to perceive. And all suffering is due to ignorance. They give the example of seeing a rope, but seeing a snake. You become fearful, becoming fearful because you're not seeing properly. That's a fact. All our anxiety is due to illusion, that our mind is distorted by our selfish desires, and therefore we're seeing the world through a distorted lens, which makes us see something that's not actually there, which is a duality, a separation from God, and we become fearful. We're turning away from Isha, we're turning away from the absolute reality where there's no duality. and we become extreme, and from that arises this illusion. So all the anxiety we have doesn't actually exist. It's due to a distorted mind, which creates a certain temporality of a certain vision of a temporality of our existence, which is illusory because we're eternal. What is the greatest fear? The greatest fear is death. Death is an illusion that makes us perceive non-existence of ourselves. And therefore, we're always in fear. So this net of great illusion, by this subduing the mind and controlling the breath and powerfully allowing us to concentrate and neglect the fluctuations in mind, which moves the mind to the pure state of sattva, and that covering is removed. And the covering is what? The covering is karma. Vyas talks about this, the commentator. He speaks of karma that covers the goodness, the soul, and impels one to commit deeds that torture us, things that bring us away from our essence, away from our pure nature. We have an essence, we have a truth, we have a reality of the soul. And that reality of the soul is eternal and blissful and full of knowledge. That's the eternality of the soul. So by karma, we're assuming another identity which is temporary and full of suffering. So karma is that. Our actions away from the soul are recorded in the consciousness, their impressions, those are called samskaras, and they fructify at a time. So karma is this storehouse of these impressions that trigger all kinds of behavioral patterns, attitudes, perspective, responses to the world that increase this network of illusion and take our awareness away from the pure soul and absorb it in this external conditioned patterns of behavior. So this is the glories of pranayama. It removes that covering. Manu states, from the performance of pranayama accompanied by the repetition of om, the impurities of the sensory powers are burnt away, just as the defiling impurities of metal are burnt away in the heat of the furnace. Vyas quotes a verse, there's no greater ascetic practice than pranayama, from which defects are purified and the light of knowledge shines. I'm kind of got a little inspiration from this to learn a little bit more pranayama to support my meditational practice. And then we should lament. We should lament if we go into our meditation and we're lethargic or we're distracted and we can't concentrate. You know, so this could be helpful. Additionally, the mind becomes fit for concentration. So karma is removed. The covering of the pure nature of the mind is removed. And then the mind becomes fit for dharana. It becomes fit for concentration. So this is this section on pranayama. Okay, are there any questions? Really sorry I was late today. I hope we didn't lose anybody because of that. Okay, would anybody like to say hello?
Hare Krishna, Mala. Please accept my humble obeisance.
Thank you, Amya.
Where do you think we should go to learn this pranayama?
I don't know. I'm not recommending it particularly, but I mean,
but it sounds very, it sounds really good.
Well, yeah, well, probably some yoga place or something. It could be effective. Yeah, I mean, there's so many. Anyway, you can ask Kasuba. You probably can find a good place where a yoga teacher that teaches that. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Gail.
Gail, Hare Krishna. I guess I'll see most of you Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
You free?
I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, okay. Good. Thank you. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello? Hope we didn't lose most of the people because I was late. Anybody else like to say hello? I get the numbers, so I know which, how many people, but sometimes it's nice if someone just says hello, I know who's there. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, Ricky, can you send me the details of everything, okay? Okay, we'll end for today. Okay. Bunch of culpa through your stuff.